This is the story of Doug Longstaff, a Sheffield man with an exceptional story from an unassuming background. In the last episode of Doug's Diaries, voiced by his son John, he vividly described his early years and family life, the home in Carbrook, and the happy days of childhood. It took us into the 1930s, where unbeknown to many, the world was about to change, and where Doug's carefree youth would be left behind forever.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British Ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
I remember going for my medical. Five doctors saw to us, our eyes, ears, chests, lungs that is, legs, feet and elsewhere. Half past day one, they said. 2 weeks later, on February 15th, Thursday, 1940, I was due to go to Strensel Camp, York, to join the Coilies, 1st 4th Battalion, for recruit training. Mum and Dad took it for granted and wished me luck. Brother Harry and Sister Flo did too. Harry, who was a shop steward at William Jessop's, tried to delay my call-up, as I was still an apprentice, but it was to no avail. I didn't mind. I mean, everybody seemed to be going either Navy, Air Force, and, like me, the Army. I got the old zinc tub down and using the copper boiler for hot water, supplementing some from the kettle, I had a bath in front of the fire. What was left of it, because they had all gone to bed. I wondered what was lying before me. I was off early. Sister and brother saw me to the station, Victoria, I think, in Sheffield. On arriving in York, I joined the other lads and paraded in front of the sergeant, who began shouting orders, the first signs of what was to come. I began to tremble slightly, but soon got over it. I mean, I was determined to do my best. I was a good listener and wished to obey. I mean, that's how I remember being brought up.
Like all of us, being away from home made Doug reminisce. And never far from his thoughts was his beloved brother, Harry.
Whenever we played games, running or football, me and my brother Harry always wanted to win. Harry ran in the Sheffield Schools races at Bramall Lane. Mum took me when I was 9 years old to watch him. We were on the cop. Harry came second. It was packed at Bramall Lane, a full house. Anyway, there was I years ago. Now I was in the army. We set off from York Station for Strensel in 3-ton trucks, and on arriving and reporting, we got our kit, just like the film. We had to laugh after.
I want you to realise you're in the army now, and everything you do matters to the army. You'll feel a bit strange at first, but officers and NCOs will give you all the help they can. We want you to become efficient soldiers, but we also want you to be happy soldiers. I can see some of you think that that's rather a tall order. But it can be done. After I've taught you, you will draw your battle dress and the rest of your clothing. The first step is to make you look like soldiers.
We were shown our respective quarters, big wooden huts. Ours was number 5 squad. My bed and wardrobe was down to the bottom left, next but one to Lance Corporal Hobbs, a Londoner. He was good. We liked him straight away. I recall him shouting at lights out, "Hands above the bedclothes, no manking." Or was it something else?
The world was both a dangerous and grave environment for the young man of the early 1940s. But as in all forms of adversity, lifetime friendships and memories were born to last.
I soon found some lads who became great pals of mine all through the army life. Jim Rawson from Cuddeth, Barnsley. Harry Guest also from Barnsley. Jack Metcalf from York. who left us after the war ended to fight in the Far East, but fortunately it was cancelled. He'd become a sergeant. I last met him when we were in Italy, Naples, Camp Transit Camp. We had just had time for a chat about old times. He was number two to me on the Bren gun in Iceland 1940-42. Jack used to cheer me on when I played football for our company. "Go on, Shagger!" That became my army nickname, don't ask me why. Two other pals, one was called Scotty, and the best one was poor old Nudger Needham, a married man with a five-year-old boy who took his own life when stationed away from us in Iceland early 1941. What a cruel shame. Nudger was a lovely man, well-liked. Scott, who I mentioned earlier, was from the same area of Sheffield. He was recalled from the army for work in the steel industry. I met him once at Bramall Lane, watching Yorkshire playing cricket. We had a good long chat. Reporting for parade, etc., didn't commence until Monday, 6 a.m. Rivale, so we had plenty of time to get sorted. Friday night, we all went for a drink in the Strensel village, and we had our photo taken Saturday when in York, 6 miles away, and a drink in the pubs. We kidded ourselves we were soldiers. We felt proud. Our sergeant was called Fellows, and full corporal was Tiny Rawson, 6 foot odd, strong as a bull, but quiet except on duty. Sergeant Fellows liked his ale, but we liked him. He was a soldier and trained as well. He was proud of us all when we finally passed out. Smart. Lance Corporal Obb told us we could have leave at Easter, so we drew lots and we won. The Sheffield Barnsley lads, 5 days at home. We were kidded, thought you were in the army, because we'd had a weekend pass 4 weeks before. I remember the RAF flying over Strensel when we were up early to get our passes and ration coupons and railway tickets. They were brave. We always spoke well of them.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone?
It was before I met Kathleen. I had no girlfriend, so I spent my time on leave with our son and Mum and Dad. Also went to a match, I believe, with some of the lads, and drinking in the pubs. Not a lot. Didn't get drunk. I was training to be a soldier, so I had to think that way. Try to be smart. Sister Flo visited me once while at Strensel. One Sunday, same day Nudger Needham was visited by his wife and five-year-old son, and his auntie. He became a great friend who I visited at his home in Lansdowne Road. He had a drink in the pub, the Lansdowne, along with Scotty, a lad who had to go back to Civvy Street to work. War effort. Whilst at Strensel, I was called up for guard duty, on sentry duty in front of the headquarters, in full view of everybody, 6 of us in pairs. 2 hours each on sentry duty and 4 hours off, 24-hour guard. I felt great after that. I was becoming a soldier. I mean, the other lad on sentry duty with me was called Simpson, ginger-haired lad. Strange, I hardly saw him after that, don't know where he went. We was expected to have loads of training to do. Route marches, day and night, rifle practice on the rifle range, bayonet practice, like the army game, in the gym, boxing. Plenty of food, better than the civilians, we got really fit. Then came time, we had the boxing, no choice. We were paired off. I fought this lad, who was rather quiet, so I didn't have much problem. The fight was stopped in my favour, so I was to fight a lad called Wee Wow. He was English. In the semi-final, in the sports hall, it was crowded, all the lads cheering us on, but I had to stay silent once the boxing started, by a loud voice sergeant shouting, "Quiet!" Tiny Rawson, our corporal, along with Sergeant Fellows, were in the corner, my corner. They thought I'd won. One remarked, "If you haven't won, my..." is a bloater. He was wrong on both accounts.
Doug and his newfound mates were clearly enjoying the opportunities that the army provided and the comradeship that came with it. Nevertheless, the cloud of war was ever present, and it wasn't long before Doug would be on the move towards that cloud, aboard the good ship RMS Andes, even though it wasn't exactly an open invite for Doug.
At the end of our training as recruits, 9 weeks, we all had to pass out our different squads on the parade ground in front of the commanding officer. A bit nerve-wracking, but we passed with full marks. We felt great and pleased our sergeant, full corporal and lance corporal, fellows Rosen and Hobbs. We were ready to be sent wherever, but we still had another 7 weeks in the infantry A barracks before leaving Strensel to go to Scotland. Stobbs Camp, Howick. Lovely place just over the border. That's when we heard France had fallen and subsequently Dunkirk happened. Rumours were flying about. We were going to Canada, but first our next station was on the Clyde, at E Camp, where we were paraded and selections were made. I wasn't chosen, but my mates called for me to join them. As they were marching off, the officer and sergeant in charge took off to the office. No one in authority was present. So I set off and rejoined my mates and marched off to the ship, the Andes.
The RMS Andes had been launched from Belfast in March 1939. You can still catch the silent film clips on Pathé Films. Just 6 months later, she was requisitioned by the Admiralty. By the time Doug appeared on board, she was an established troop ship, having made crosses to the Far East, Egypt and Australasia. Next stop, Iceland.
We embarked on the Andes first and so entered the cabins on A deck, but before we got settled in, the sound of someone in authority shouting, "Everybody out! Downstairs, below the ship's engine room," we were directed below the waterline on the bottom. Hammocks and big thick squares called biscuits we slept on. The meals were very good. We felt embarrassed to eat food fit for the rich. Boat drill was called each morning. Once we set sail, ours wasn't boats. They had all been allocated. We were assigned rafts and life belts had to be worn or life jackets. Some like pillows, front and back. Others, four large squares of cork, enclosed. Uncomfortable, but very necessary to save lives. We had destroyers to shepherd us all the way to Reykjavik, the Icelandic capital. But we were last off the ship. On landing, having forced ourselves on the people, we were not guests, same as if the Germans had taken it. But we were welcomed in a kind of way. Our first task was to guard the lighthouse at Vatnes. After a week or so, we rejoined the rest of the lads and marched about 8 miles to Egilstadda. The camp was situated near a farm which had ponies used for trekking for the visitors. A large building was nearby, but we were under canvas because the weather was very warm. June, July, August was their summer. The rest of the year wasn't very nice weather, especially between November to April, but that came later. We did the usual training, digging if we could, parade guard duty, and football. I became Bren Gunner number one during our time in Egilstadda, Jack Metcalf number two. We did pony patrols about 10 miles round trip, like cowboys. The mail, mainly letters from home, caught up with us. It was intended for us when we were stationed in Stobbs Camp in Scotland. Mother had baked me homemade bread cakes, but I had to dump them in the waste bin. Such a shame. They had all gone green. Such was a love for her son. Such was her love for her son.
Love is the sweetest thing. What else on earth could ever bring such happiness to everything as love goes for it?
During our stay, our Company C were ordered on a forced march 19 miles over the hills to Seydisfjord, telling us Germans had landed, which was a ploy to teach us the art of readiness for any eventuality. It worked. Most of us suffered blisters when we were attended to by the medics. A football match was quickly arranged between our company and B Company. I couldn't play for blisters, but they didn't pick me. Good job. We lost 3-1. Nudgy Needham visited us. He was in the Pioneer Platoon attached to B Company. I'd been in Nudgy's home and pub in Lansdowne Road. It's so sad to think of Nudgy Needham. He was such a lovable character, well liked, because on 6th January 1941, he took his own life. He must have become terribly depressed. So tragic.
We hope that fate may bring love story to you.
Early August, warm weather. When we returned to Egilstadde, I walked back with the lads and felt all right. I could have ridden on the trucks, but I wanted to be a man. To prove myself, I could do it. Autumn approached. The weather changes, so Nissen huts were being erected all over Iceland. We were detailed to help the engineers in the process. It was great. The time came when we marched back to Budureyri, Reidisfjord, our camp or station. Each platoon were allocated a Nissen hut, 13, 14, 15, and headquarters formed C Company, 13 platoon, that was us. We were detailed to dig defensive positions on a nearby hill, facing the end of the fjord. We could see the ships arriving. And on the day of my 21st birthday, I received all mail sent to me from home, 23rd of October 1940. Lucky. I got a wristwatch, lighter and a ring and cards. The area was called Fox Farm. But for all our endeavour, the general in charge of the island forces termed the positions no good. Still, it kept us busy. When the snows came and winter set in, daylight was reduced to 5 hours, so we spent time going to school lessons and listening to lectures, and we had guard duty to do. We unloaded shipping during daylight hours. Our army pay then was 3 shillings a day. They kept our money, and if we needed to buy anything, we had to ask our officer, so we were in credit all the time, about 18 shillings a week. Not bad, about £42 a year.
It wouldn't be long before the British would hand over control of Iceland to the Americans. It was time to move on. But there was still time to enjoy life, to break up the tough training schedule.
Ensa parties visited Iceland. Some good turns. The stage was erected by our lads, working with the engineers. Bingo was played each Friday night in the Naffy Nissen hut. Never won anything. When Christmas came, but 13 platoon, us, had to work in the kitchen and serve to the company. We had leftovers. They forgot about us. The quartermaster thought we were on jankers. Army punishment. Idiot. We were on duty. It was our first Christmas in the army. Our division, 49th Polar Bear and 52nd Division, trained to be a mountain division. But after being rigged out with all the equipment, including snowshoes and skis, and spending nights out under small tents, eating pemmican food, etc., it was cancelled. We gave back the equipment. Typical army.
Sadly, the dangers of these times were also never far away.
During 1941, 8 of our battalion lost their lives in a storm on the mountain slopes between Reidisfjord and Seydisfjord. The lads were from B Company. 3 Sheffielders, Sergeant Major Froggatt was one. I was visiting next door Nissen hut in S Company, 3 Motor Platoon, when the Nissen hut front door blew in and was flung all the way, knocking the breeze block wall down at the other end. We all remarked, pity anyone out in this weather, little knowing that the lads from B Company were dying. Terrible to think of it. This was training, not fighting. They were buried there in Iceland. I was one of the 6 lads in the firing party, doing present arms, whilst the services were read over the coffins and graves.
It's clear from Doug's diaries that his love of sport, and particularly football, shines through. Once again, there was an opportunity to put his army boots to good use. All this before turning his attention to another attractive proposition.
There were games of football to be played. I participated in quite a few for platoon, company and battalion, scoring a few goals. Some I still remember, especially the good ones. There's the one I scored for D Company as a guest, our third mortar team attached to D Company. At Seyðisfjörður, a 30-yarder from the left wing on the run for goal. Hit it on the bounce, it flew in via the underside of the crossbar. Its effect was electrifying. I was feted as a hero, being the winning goal. Roy of the Rovers, later in Akureyri, playing for S Company, a corner from the right. The ball hit my head as I was facing goal 15 yards out. Fast and hard ball. It ricocheted and into the goal before anyone saw it and bounced off a Nissan hook tin roof. I just walked away while the player who took the corner kick waving to me no one else knew. There wasn't any goal netting. Before leaving Iceland, still at Akureyri, and before the Americans took over, I played in two matches, one after another, on left wing. We lost both games. To say the least, I felt shattered. I first met Kathleen in the industry, the passageway, Dunlop Street, Carbrook. My older brother by 2 years, who was waiting on at the pub, told me of her presence. I was on leave from the army stationed in Iceland. The year was 1941. December the 15th, I was drinking with two friends. It was a pleasant surprise, though it shouldn't have been, because my sister, who worked with Kath at Tinsley Wire, wrote saying this girl would like to correspond. And I got a Christmas card from Kathleen, then a letter on my birthday, October the 23rd, my 21st. A card with a small photo, head and shoulders, which brought a smile to my face. She looked very attractive, only 16 and a half at the time. I later found out she did it on impulse, felt sorry for me, I guess. All the lads in our platoon cheered, saying, "Doug's got a girlfriend." I pinned it on the inside of the Nissan hut, a proud owner. They all laughed and cheered. Great lads. But that was the beginning of our lives together. But that was never my intention, nor Kathleen's. That night after, she went back to her friend's home, where she was staying the night. Actually, it was an adopted cousin of mine, Joyce Footy, living in Stoven Road, Darnell. I arranged to meet them there and walk Kathleen home with Joyce, also Kath's little sister, two-year-old Arlene. Not knowing where Kath lived, I just followed on, carrying little Arlene. We seemed to be walking for ages. Finally got there, Woodthorpe Estate. Never heard of it. 401 Hastela Road South, where I am now, as I am writing. But a lot of things have happened since I walked Kathleen home that day, on December the 16th, 1941. Meeting her family, Mam and Dad, sisters, Joan, Arlene. Carol came a year later. Brother Willis, we got on fine. Grandma Whelan, Johnny Whelan. Having a drink in the Richmond Hotel with Kath's family, or friends. The news came that Kath didn't wish to see me anymore, so being on leave, I had to make the best of it. So, three pals and I went drinking in the Cricket Inn, Wyburn. Got myself drunk, slept it off on Mother's sofa, then went out into town, and strangely, was sober. When I got back home, where a message was waiting for me, Kath wants to see me again. I was so glad, but it was only platonic. It was all I wished, just then. I'd begun to get attached. I liked her. I didn't know about Kath.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you.
Our party on leave had to report back on Boxing Day to the ship at Greenock, Scotland, which was later extended 2 days, so we left Boxing Day night. I personally had a good time. Kathleen and family and friends. Kath's mam, Mary, and dad, Willis Powell, gave me about a dozen or more records to take back to play in Iceland. Very good of them. We, the lads, enjoyed some happy hours listening. The records were shared amongst the rest of the company. Never saw them again. It helped when I caught the tram and then the train, with Kathleen wishing me well, and my sister and brother too. but it was an awful feeling having to go back to Iceland. I was kissed goodbye by Sister Flo, but most of all by Kathleen, our first kiss. It was a nice feeling. Kath and I carried on writing to each other on occasions until our time was up and we left Iceland for good. We packed our bags and boarded the liner or troop ship for home, England, but called at Reykjavik to pick up more troops. Our duties on board ship were as waiters at mealtime, so we got plenty to eat, far better food than we used to. Arriving in Greenock, Scotland, we travelled on trains to Blighty, as we called England. Our destination was Ross-on-Wye, a beautiful little town between Gloucester and Hereford.
Things were beginning to look up for Doug's love life, and he was finally based back in England.
After marching in order, smartly to impress the locals, as always in the army, an army camp was waiting for us, full of Nissen huts, cookhouse and places to eat, dining rooms he called them, a rugby and football areas and a rifle range. Next 48 hours we were excused duty because of the difference coming to England from Iceland. It took us all our time to walk to the cookhouse and to do anything else. It was August 1942 and it was hot and dry. There were two cinemas and a pub at every corner, some in between, but no beer, only cider. But it was drinkable, and could get drunk if you didn't watch out. We enjoyed ourselves, if that's the right word.
But sadness and tragedy were never far away. Unfortunately, this time, it was very close to home.
We had leave December the 7th, 1941, December the 26th, 2 days extension. We're back of the queue, but because of a family tragedy, I got leave because it was my turn. My dear elder brother went missing from home. It wasn't a happy time, terrible. I went back to camp at Ross-on-Wye, only to get home leave again when my brother's body was found. It was awful. The sadness, the bereavement. I found it hard not to cry. Oh, I cried because Harry was the one I always looked up to. In Civvy Street, he was a good man. I loved him so.
Everything in Ross-on-Wye was now being geared towards Normandy.
We all learned to drive on the road between Hereford and Monmouth. Being involved in two accidents, I was trying to engage the gears to second, approaching a steep descending hill. The driving instructor took the wheel with oars hitting the bank at the angle when stopped. The Bren gun carrier toppled over, throwing three of the lads into the road. Me and the driver were still behind the wheel, as it were. Our division, the 49th Polar Bear, were like other divisions, preparing for D-Day. Thus we, the 1st 4th Coily Battalion, we ordered to train for the landings at Rothsay on the Isle of Bute in Scotland. It implied boarding ship and landing in the craft via rope ladders in fighting gear and assembling our 3-inch mortars plus bombs. Number 1 and the base plate, number 2, that's me, had the barrel, number 3 the bipod, plus our rifles. When ready, the landing craft set off for the beach, where the assimilated action was being displayed, as near as they could to a real war. Fireworks going off, real tracer bullets on prepared lines, which you kept away from. We fired our mortars as we approached the section or beach, using sandbags under and around the base plate to keep the 3-inch mortar steady. An umpire was in attendance to check our efforts.
Enemy shells begin to drop among the landing craft, closing the shore. Beachheads are established. Across the broad expanse of sea, reaching to the distant misty horizon, the bridge of ships and landing craft, which has its abutment on the shores of England. This is it. They're on the beach, plunging waist deep into the sea and threading their way among the steel asparagus tops which project out of the water, the anti-invasion barriers with mines on their tips, one of the devices which was studied long before invasion began.
Arriving back in Sheffield, April 28th, 1946, for a day-long journey taking me from my mates in Austria, some already being demobbed, Jim Rawson, full corporal, and Cliff Martin, sergeant, Jim from Cuddeth near Barnsley, and Cliff from Carbrook, two great pals among many. I can still hear Jim's pleading words, "Don't go, Doug. Sorry," I said. "I'm married now. So long."
The war was over for Douglas Longstaff, regiment number 469-3647. It was time to go home, to where the clouds would lift and the sunshine would come through.
I caught the ferry at Calais for Dover, then the train to Aldershot, where the party I was in were demobbed. We all had a meal, collected our demob suits, etc., and caught the train north. I got off at Midland Station, making my way by tram to Darnell. A young lad asked to carry my bag. I gave him 2 shillings. The house, 401 Hastler Road South, now being my home, living with Kathleen for the remainder of our marriage, which in most ways was correct. I was really like a stranger. As well as Kath, there were Dad, brother and 3 sisters. Kath's mum, having sadly died in December, breast cancer, she was the one person who persuaded Kath to marry me. I believe so. Kath made me a meal, after which I opened my kit bag and suitcase, showing what I'd brought back. The girls, Joan, Arlene and Carol, were all excited. Kath's dad thanked me. I gave him a pipe and tobacco. Kath was quiet. We all had fish and chips for supper or fish cakes. Then it was bedtime. Kath and me talked and smoked in bed most of the night. We said good night and slept. What a day. No love, no nothing. So strange. We were like 2 strangers, but gradually things got better and we soon settled in a routine, as married couples do. Me starting work back at William Jessop's and Kath looking after her dad and sisters, a full-time job. Best lass at Woodthorpe. That's what was said about Kath. And it was true.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring